Chapter 4.
And of course Celia will have custody of the children.
Of course.
Then what about the old rectory? I don't imagine you'll want to settle down with Julia bang at our gates. The children look on it as their home, you know. Robin's got no place of his own till his uncle dies. After all, you never used the studio, did you? Robin was saying only the other day what a good playroom it would make, big enough for badminton.
Robin can have the old rectory.
Now, with regard to money, Celia and Robin naturally don't want to accept anything for themselves, but there's the question of the children's education.
That will be all right. I'll see the lawyers about it.
Well, I think that's everything, said Mulcaster. You know, I've seen a few divorces in my time, and I've never known one work out so happily for all concerned. Almost always, however matey people are at the start, bad blood crops up when they get down to detail. Mind you, I don't mind saying there have been times in the last 2 years when I thought you were treating Celia a bit rough. It's hard to tell with one's own sister, but I've always thought her a jolly attractive girl. The sort of girl any chap would be glad to have. Artistic, too, just down your street. But I must admit, you're a good picker. I've always had a soft spot for Julia. Anyway, as things have turned out, everyone seems satisfied. Robin's been mad about Celia for a year or more. Do you know him?
Vaguely. A half-baked pimply youth, as I remember him.
Oh, I wouldn't quite say that. He's rather young, of course. But the great thing is that John and Caroline adore him. You've got two grand kids there, Charles. Remember me to Julia. Wish her all the best for old time's sake.
So you're being divorced, said my father.
Isn't that rather unnecessary, after you've been happy together all these years?
We weren't particularly happy, you know.
Weren't you? Were you not? I distinctly remember last Christmas seeing you together, thinking how happy you looked and wondering why. You'll find it very disturbing, you know, starting off again. How old are you? 34? It's no age to be starting. You ought to be settling down. Have you made any plans?
Yes, I'm marrying again as soon as the divorce is through.
Well, I do call that a lot of nonsense. I can understand a man wishing he hadn't married and trying to get out of it, although I never felt anything of the kind myself. But to get rid of one wife and take up with another immediately is beyond all reason.
Celia was always perfectly civil to me.
I had quite a liking for her in a way. If you couldn't be happy with her, why on earth should you expect to be happy with anyone else? Take my advice, my dear boy, and give up the whole idea.
Why bring Julia and me into this? Asked Rex. If Celia wants to marry again, well and good, let her. That's your business and hers. But I should have thought Julia and I were quite happy as we are. You can't say I've been difficult. Lots of chaps would have cut up nasty. I hope I'm a man of the world. I've had my own fish to fry too, but a divorce is a different thing altogether. I've never known a divorce do anyone any good.
That's your affair and Julia's.
Oh, Julia's set on it. What I hoped was you might be able to talk her round. I've tried to keep out of the way as much as I could. If I've been around too much, just tell me, I shan't mind. But there's too much going on altogether at the moment, what with Bridie wanting me to clear out of the house. It's disturbing, and I've got a lot on my mind.
Rex's public life was approaching a climacteric. Things had not gone as smoothly with him as he had planned. I knew nothing of finance, but I heard it said that his dealings were badly looked on by orthodox conservatives. Even his good qualities of geniality and impetuosity counted against him, for his parties at Brideshead got talked about. There was always too much about him in the papers. He was one with the press lords and their sad-eyed, smiling hangers-on. In his speeches he said the sort of thing which made a story in Fleet Street, and that did him no good with his party chiefs. Only war could put Rex's fortunes right and carry him into power. A divorce would do him no great harm. It was rather that with a big bank running he could not look up from the table.
"If Julia insists on a divorce, I suppose she must have it," he said. "But she couldn't have chosen a worse time. Tell her to hang on a bit, Charles, there's a good fellow."
Bridie's widow said, "So you're divorcing one divorced man and marrying another. It sounds rather complicated, but my dear—she called me my dear about 20 times— I've usually found every Catholic family has one lapsed member, and it's often the nicest."
Julia had just returned from a luncheon party given by Lady Roscommon in honour of Brideshead's engagement.
"What's she like?"
"Majestic and voluptuous. Common, of course. Husky voice. Big mouth. Small eyes. Dyed hair. I'll tell you one thing. She's lied to Bridie about her age. She's a good 45. I don't see her providing an heir. Bridie can't take his eyes off her. He was gloating on her in the most revolting way all through luncheon."
"Friendly?"
"Goodness, yes, in a condescending way. You see, I imagine she's been used to bossing things rather in naval circles, with flag lieutenants trotting round and young officers on the make sucking up to her.
Well, she clearly couldn't do a great deal of bossing at Aunt Fanny's, so it put her rather at ease to have me there as the black sheep. She concentrated on me, in fact, asked my advice about shops and things, said, rather pointedly, she hoped to see me often in London. I think Bridie's scruples only extend to her sleeping under the same roof with me. Apparently, I can do her no serious harm in a hat shop or hairdresser's or lunching at the Ritz. The scruples are all on Bridie's part, anyway. The widow is madly tough.
Does she boss him?
Not yet, much. He's in an amorous stupor, poor beast, and doesn't quite know where he is. She's just a good-hearted woman who wants a good home for her children and isn't going to let anything get in her way. She's playing up the religious stuff at the moment for all it's worth. I dare say she'll go easier when she's settled. The divorces were much talked of among our friends. Even in the summer of general alarm, there were still corners where private affairs commanded first attention. My wife was able to make it understood that the business was at the same time a matter of congratulation for her and reproach for me. That she had behaved wonderfully, had stood it longer than anyone but she would have done. Robin was 7 years younger and a little immature for his age, they whispered in their private corners, but he was absolutely devoted to poor Celia, and really she deserved it after all she had been through. As for Julia and me, that was an old story.
To put it crudely, said my cousin Jasper, as though he had never in his life put anything otherwise, I don't see why you bother to marry.
Summer passed. Delirious crowds cheered Neville Chamberlain's return from Munich. Rex made a rabid speech in the House of Commons which sealed his fate one way or the other, sealed it, as is sometimes done with naval orders, to be opened later at sea. Julia's family lawyers, whose black tin boxes painted Marquess of Marchmain seemed to fill a room, began the slow process of her divorce. My own brisker firm, two doors down, were weeks ahead with my affairs. It was necessary for Rex and Julia to separate formally, and since, for the time being, Brideshead was still her home, she remained there and Rex removed his trunks and valet to their house in London. Evidence was taken against Julia and me in my flat. A date was fixed for Brideshead's wedding, earlier in the Christmas holidays, so that his future stepchildren might take part. One afternoon in November, Julia and I stood at a window in the drawing-room, watching the wind at work, stripping the lime trees, sweeping down the yellow leaves, sweeping them up and round and along the terrace and lawns, trailing them through puddles and over wet grass, pasting them on walls and window panes, leaving them at length in sodden piles against the stonework.
"We shan't see them in spring," said Julia.
"Perhaps never again."
"Once before," I said, "I went away thinking I should never return.
Perhaps years later, to what's left of it, with what's left of us." A door opened and shut in the darkling room behind us. Wilcox approached through the firelight into the dusk about the long windows.
"A telephone message, my lady, from Lady Cordelia."
"Lady Cordelia? Where was she?"
"In London, my lady."
"Wilcox, how lovely! Is she coming home?"
"She was just starting for the station. She will be here after dinner."
"I haven't seen her for 12 years, I said. "Not since the evening when we dined together and she spoke of being a nun. The evening when I painted the drawing-room at Marchmain House. She was an enchanting child."
"She's had an odd life. First the convent, then, when that was no good, the war in Spain. I've not seen her since then. The other girls who went with the ambulance came back when the war was over. She stayed on, getting people back to their homes, helping in the prison camps. An odd girl. She's grown up quite plain, you know."
"Does she know about us?"
"Yes, she wrote me a sweet letter."
It hurt to think of Cordelia growing up quite plain, to think of all that burning love spending itself on serum injections and delousing powder. When she arrived, tired for her journey, rather shabby, moving in the manner of one who has no interest in pleasing, I thought her an ugly woman. It was odd, I thought, how the same ingredients, differently dispensed, could produce Brideshead, Sebastian, Julia, and her. She was unmistakably their sister, without any of Julia's or Sebastian's grace, without Brideshead's gravity. She seemed brisk and matter-of-fact, steeped in the atmosphere of camp and dressing station, so accustomed to gross suffering as to lose the finer shades of pleasure. She looked more than her 26 years. Hard living had roughened her. Constant intercourse in a foreign tongue had worn away the nuances of speech. She straddled a little as she sat by the fire, and when she said, "It's wonderful to be home," it sounded to my ears like the grunt of an animal returning to its basket. Those were the impressions of the first half hour, sharpened by the contrast with Julia's white skin and silk and jewelled hair, and with my memories of her as a child.
"My job's over in Spain," she said. "The authorities were very polite, thanked me for all I'd done, gave me a medal and sent me packing. It looks as though there'll be plenty of the same sort of work over here soon."
Then she said, "Is it too late to see Nanny?"
"No, she sits up to all hours with her wireless."
We went up all three together to the old nursery. Julia and I always spent part of our day there. Nanny Hawkins and my father were two people who seemed impervious to change, neither an hour older than when I first knew them. A wireless set had now been added to Nanny Hawkins' small assembly of pleasures. The rosary, the peerage with its neat brown paper wrapping protecting the red and gold covers, the photographs, and holiday souvenirs on her table. When we broke it to her that Julia and I were to be married, she said, "Well, dear, I hope it's all for the best," for it was not part of her religion to question the propriety of Julia's actions. Brideshead had never been a favourite with her. She greeted the news of his engagement with, "He's certainly taken long enough to make up his mind," and when the search through Debrett afforded no information about Mrs. Muspratt's connections, "She's caught him, I dare say." We found her, as always in the evening, at the fireside with her teapot and the wool rug she was making.
"I knew you'd be up," she said. "Mr. Wilcox sent to tell me you were coming."
"I brought you some lace."
"Well, dear, that is nice, just like her poor ladyship used to wear at mass. Though why they made it black I never did understand, seeing lace is white, naturally. That's very welcome, I'm sure." "May I turn off the wireless, Nanny?" "Why, of course. I didn't notice it was on in the pleasure of seeing you." "What have you done to your hair?" "I know, it's terrible. I must get all that put right now I'm back. Darling Nanny."
As we sat there talking, and I saw Cordelia's fond eyes on all of us, I began to realise that she too had a beauty of her own.
"I saw Sebastian last month."
"What a time he's been gone. Was he quite well?"
"Not very. That's why I went. It's quite near, you know, from Spain to Tunis. He's with the monks there." "I hope they looked after him properly. I expect they find him a regular handful. He always sends to me at Christmas, but it's not the same as having him home. Why, you must all always be going abroad, I never did understand, just like his lordship. When there was that talk about going to war with Munich, I said to myself, there's Cordelia and Sebastian and his lordship all abroad. That'll be very awkward for them."
"I wanted him to come home with me, but he wouldn't. He's got a beard now, you know, and he's very religious."
"That I won't believe, not even if I see it. He was always a little heathen. Brideshead was one for church, not Sebastian. And a beard, only fancy. Such a nice fair skin as he had. Always looked clean, though he'd not been near water all day. While Brideshead, there was no doing anything with, scrub as you might."
"It's frightening," Julia once said, "to think how completely you have forgotten Sebastian." "He was the forerunner." "That's what you said in the storm. I've thought since, perhaps I'm only a forerunner too."
"Perhaps," I thought, while her words still hung in the air between us like a wisp of tobacco smoke, a thought to fade and vanish like smoke without a trace. "Perhaps all our loves are merely hints and symbols, vagabond language scrawled on gateposts and paving stones along the weary road that others have tramped before us. Perhaps you and I are types, and this sadness which sometimes falls between us springs from disappointment in our search, each straining through and beyond the other, snatching a glimpse now and then of the shadow which turns the corner, always a pace or two ahead of us." I had not forgotten Sebastian. He was with me daily in Julia, or rather it was Julia I had known in him, in those distant Arcadian days.
"That's cold comfort for a girl," she said when I tried to explain. "How do I know I shan't suddenly turn out to be somebody else? It's an easy way to chuck."
I had not forgotten Sebastian. Every stone of the house had a memory of him, and hearing him spoken of by Cordelia as someone she had seen a month ago, my lost friend filled my thoughts. When we left the nursery, I said, "I want to hear all about Sebastian."
"Tomorrow, it's a long story."
And next day, working through the windswept park, she told me. "I heard he was dying," she said. "A journalist in Burgos told me, who'd just arrived from North Africa, a down-and-out called Flight, who people said was an English lord, whom the fathers had found starving and taken in at a monastery near Carthage. That was how the story reached me. I knew it couldn't be quite true. However little we did for Sebastian, he at least got his money sent him, but I started off at once.
It was all quite easy. I went to the consulate first, and they knew all about him. He was in the infirmary of the head house of some missionary fathers. The consul's story was that Sebastian had turned up in Tunis one day in a motor bus from Algiers and had applied to be taken on as a missionary lay brother. The fathers took one look at him and turned him down. Then he started drinking. He lived in a little hotel on the edge of the Arab quarter. I went to see the place later. It was a bar with a few rooms over it, kept by a Greek, smelling of hot oil and garlic and stale wine and old clothes, a place where the small Greek traders came and played draughts and listened to the wireless. He stayed there a month, drinking Greek absinthe, occasionally wandering out, they didn't know where, coming back and drinking again. They were afraid he would come to harm and followed him sometimes, but he only went to the church, or took a car to the monastery outside the town. They loved him there. He's still loved, you see, wherever he goes, whatever condition he's in. It's a thing about him he'll never lose. You should have heard the proprietor and his family talk of him, tears running down their cheeks. They'd clearly robbed him right and left, but they'd looked after him and tried to make him eat his food. That was the thing that shocked them about him, that he wouldn't eat. There he was, with all that money, so thin. Some of the clients of the place came in while we were talking, in very peculiar French. They all had the same story. Such a good man, they said. It made them unhappy to see him so low. They thought very ill of his family for leaving him like that. It couldn't happen with their people, they said, and I dare say they're right. Anyway, that was later. After the consulate, I went straight to the monastery and saw the superior. He was a grim old Dutchman who'd spent 50 years in Central Africa. He told me his part of the story, how Sebastian had turned up, just as the consul said, with his beard and a suitcase, and asked to be admitted as a lay brother. He was very earnest, the superior said. Cordelia imitated his guttural tones. She had an aptitude for mimicry, I remembered, in the schoolroom. "Please do not think there is any doubt of that. He is quite sane and quite in earnest. He wanted to go to the bush, as far away as he could get, among the simplest people, to the cannibals. The superior said, "We have no cannibals in our missions." He said, "Well, pygmies would do, or just a primitive village somewhere on a river, or lepers. Lepers would do best of anything." The superior said, "We have plenty of lepers, but they live in our settlements with doctors and nuns. It is all very orderly." He thought again, and said perhaps lepers were not what he wanted. Was there not some small church by a river? He always wanted a river, you see, which he could look after when the priest was away. The superior said, "Yes, there are such churches. Now tell me about yourself." "Oh, I'm nothing," he said. "We see some queer fish." Cordelia lapsed again into mimicry. "He was a queer fish, but he was very earnest." The superior told him about the novitiate and the training, and said, "You are not a young man. You do not seem strong to me." He said, "No, I don't want to be trained. I don't want to do things that need training." The superior said, "My friend, you need a missionary for yourself." And he said, "Yes, of course." Then he sent him away. Next day he came back again. He'd been drinking. He said he'd decided to become a novice and be trained. "Well," said the superior, "there are certain things that are impossible for a man in the bush. One of them is drinking. It is not the worst thing, but it is nevertheless quite fatal. I sent him away." Then he kept coming 2 or 3 times a week, always drunk, until the superior gave orders that the porter was to keep him out. I said, "Oh dear, I'm afraid he was a terrible nuisance to you, but of course that's a thing they don't understand in a place like that." The superior simply said, "I do not think there was anything I could do to help him except pray." He was a very holy old man, and recognised it in others. Holiness? "Oh, yes, Charles, that's what you've got to understand about Sebastian." Well, finally, one day, they found Sebastian lying outside the main gate unconscious. He had walked out, usually he took a car, and fallen down and lain there all night. At first, they thought he was merely drunk again. Then they realised he was very ill. So they put him in the infirmary, where he's been ever since. I stayed a fortnight with him till he was over the worst of his illness. He looked terrible, any age, rather bald, with a straggling beard, but he had his old sweet manner. They'd given him a room to himself. It was barely more than a monk's cell, with a bed and a crucifix and white walls. At first he couldn't talk much, and was not at all surprised to see me. Then he was surprised and wouldn't talk much, until just before I was going, when he told me all that had been happening to him. It was mostly about Kurt, his German friend. Well, you met him, so you know all about that. He sounds gruesome, but as long as Sebastian had him to look after, he was happy. He told me he'd practically given up drinking at one time while he and Kurt lived together. Kurt was ill and had a wound that wouldn't heal. Sebastian saw him through that. Then they went to Greece when Kurt got well. You know how Germans sometimes seem to discover a sense of decency when they get to a classical country. Seems to have worked with Kurt. Sebastian says he became quite human in Athens. Then he got sent to prison. I couldn't quite make out why. Apparently it wasn't particularly his fault, some brawl with an official. Once he was locked up, the German authorities got at him. It was the time when they were rounding up all their nationals from all parts of the world to make them into Nazis. Kurt didn't want to leave Greece, but the Greeks didn't want him, and he was marched straight from prison with a lot of other toughs into a German boat and shipped home. Sebastian went after him, and for a year could find no trace. Then in the end he ran him to earth, dressed as a stormtrooper in a provincial town. At first he wouldn't have anything to do with Sebastian, spouted all the official jargon about the rebirth of his country and his belonging to his country, and finding self-realisation in the life of the race. But it was only skin deep with him. 6 years of Sebastian had taught him more than a year of Hitler. Eventually he chucked it, admitted he hated Germany and wanted to get out. I don't know how much it was simply the call of the easy life, sponging on Sebastian, bathing in the Mediterranean, sitting about in cafes, having his shoes polished. Sebastian says it wasn't entirely that. Kurt had just begun to grow up in Athens. It may be he's right. Anyway, he decided to try and get out. But it didn't work. He always got into trouble, whatever he did, Sebastian said. They caught him and put him in a concentration camp. Sebastian couldn't get near him or hear a word of him. He couldn't even find what camp he was in. He hung about for nearly a year in Germany, drinking again, until one day in his cups he took up with a man who was just out of the camp where Kurt had been and learned that he had hanged himself in his hut the first week. So that was the end of Europe for Sebastian. He went back to Morocco, where he had been happy, and gradually drifted down the coast from place to place, until one day, when he had sobered up, his drinking goes in pretty regular bouts now, he conceived the idea of escaping to the savages. And there he was. I didn't suggest his coming home. I knew he wouldn't, and he was still too weak to argue about it. He seemed quite happy by the time I left. He'll never be able to go into the bush, of course, or join the order, but the Father Superior is going to take charge of him. They had the idea of making him a sort of underporter. There are usually a few odd hangers-on in a religious house, you know, people who can't quite fit in either to the world or to the monastic rule. I suppose I'm something of the sort myself, but as I don't happen to drink, I'm more employable. We had reached the turn in our walk, the stone bridge at the foot of the last and smallest lake, under which the swollen waters fell into a cataract to the stream below. Beyond, the path doubled back towards the house. We paused at the parapet, looking down into the dark water. I once had a governess who jumped off this bridge and drowned herself. Yes, I know. How could you know? It was the first thing I ever heard about you, before I ever met you. How very odd. Have you told Julia this about Sebastian? The substance of it, not quite as I told you. She never loved him, you know, as we do. Do. The word reproached me. There was no past tense in Cordelia's verb, to love. Poor Sebastian, I said. It's too pitiful. How will it end? I think I can tell you exactly, Charles. I've seen others like him, and I believe they are very near and dear to God. He'll live on, half in, half out of the community, a familiar figure, pottering round with his broom and his bunch of keys. He'll be a great favourite with the old fathers, something of a joke to the novices. Everyone will know about his drinking. He'll disappear for 2 or 3 days every month or so, and they'll all nod and smile and say in their various accents, "Old Sebastian's on the spree again," and then he'll come back dishevelled and shamefaced and be more devout for a day or two in the chapel. He'll probably have little hiding places about the garden where he keeps a bottle and takes a swig now and then on the sly. They'll bring him forward to act as a guide whenever they have an English-speaking visitor, and he will be completely charming, so that before they go they'll ask about him, and perhaps be given a hint that he has high connections at home. If he lives long enough, generations of missionaries in all kinds of remote places will think of him as a queer old character who was somehow part of the home in their student days, and remember him in their masses. He'll develop little eccentricities of devotion, intense personal cults of his own. He'll be found in the chapel at odd times and missed when he's expected. Then, one morning, after one of his drinking bouts, he'll be picked up at the gate dying, and show by a mere flicker of the eyelid that he's conscious when they give him the last sacraments. It's not such a bad way of getting through one's life. I thought of the youth with the teddy bear under the flowering chestnuts. It's not what one would have foretold, I said. I suppose he doesn't suffer. Oh, yes, I think he does. One can have no idea what the suffering may be, to be maimed as he is. No dignity, no power of will. No one is ever wholly without suffering. It's taken that form with him. I've seen so much suffering in the last few years. There's so much coming for everybody soon. It's the spring of love. And then in condescension to my paganism, she added, He's in a very beautiful place, you know, by the sea. White cloisters, a bell tower, rows of green vegetables, and a monk watering them when the sun is low. I laughed.
You knew I wouldn't understand.
You and Julia, she said, and then as we moved on towards the house. When you met me last night, did you think, Poor Cordelia, such an engaging child, grown up a plain and pious spinster full of good works, did you think thwarted? It was no time for prevarication. Yes, I said I did. I don't now, so much. It's funny, she said. That's exactly the word I thought of for you and Julia. When we were up in the nursery with Nanny, thwarted passion, I thought. She spoke with that gentle, infinitesimal inflection of mockery which descended to her from her mother. But later that evening the words came back to me poignantly. Julia wore the embroidered Chinese robe which she often used when we were dining alone at Brideshead. It was a robe whose weight and stiff folds stressed her repose. Her neck rose exquisitely from the plain gold circle at her throat. Her hands lay still among the dragons in her lap. It was thus that I had rejoiced to see her nights without number, and that night, watching her as she sat between the firelight and the shaded lamp, unable to look away for love of her beauty, I suddenly thought, When else have I seen her like this? Why am I reminded of another moment of vision? And it came back to me that this was how she had sat in the liner before the storm. This was how she had looked, and I realized that she had regained what I thought she had lost forever, the magical sadness which had drawn me to her, the thwarted look that had seemed to say, Surely I was made for some other purpose than this. That night I woke in the darkness and lay awake, turning over in my mind the conversation with Cordelia. How I had said, You knew I would not understand. How often it seemed to me I was brought up short, like a horse in full stride, suddenly refusing an obstacle, backing against the spurs, too shy even to put his nose at it and look at the thing. Another image came to me, of an Arctic hut and a trapper alone with his furs and oil lamp and log fire, everything dry and shipshape and warm inside, and outside the last blizzard of winter raging and the snow piling up against the door. Quite silently, a great weight forming against the timber, the bolt straining in its socket, minute by minute in the darkness outside, the white heap sealing the door, until quite soon, when the wind dropped and the sun came out on the ice slopes and the thaw set in, a block would move, slide and tumble, high above, gather weight, till the whole hillside seemed to be falling, and the little lighted place would open and splinter and disappear, rolling with the avalanche into the ravine.